morning. Back in Africa, where I was in the country of Gabon, I would say Belamasoha, which means, did you get up yet? And you would say, eh, which means yes, nawe. So why don't you practice that? It goes, eh, nawe. Oh, you guys are good. You guys are good. Okay. Well, it's a privilege to be back here and to share with you again the word that God has given me to share about missions, this fifth Sunday of Missions Week. I'm so proud of this church that you make this a priority every year, and also that your missions budget is very significant. And the big idea today is that to reach the world, it takes the church and its sent ones. Of course, the church's missionaries are part of the church, but I want to emphasize that. To reach the world, it takes the church and its sent ones. As I explained 2 weeks ago, the Antioch church was a missionary church, a trailblazing church, out of which God sent ones who fearlessly took the gospel to the Gentile nations. They didn't call them missionaries back then, they called them sent ones. And if these men had refused to leave Antioch after the Holy Spirit called them to go, the story of the book of Acts would have ended very, very differently. In the same way, if God calls some of us to be his sent ones and we don't go, we refuse to go, the history of the world is affected. And if we go, the history of the world is affected. So let me just read this again, the story of Elijah, who was called to be a sent one, and this is how he was called. So Elijah went and found Elisha. Elijah was a great prophet. Elisha was not. He was a farmer. The son of Shaphat, plowing a field. There were 12 teams plowing a field, and Elisha was plowing with the 12th team. Elijah went over to him and threw his cloak across his shoulders and then walked away. Elisha left the oxen standing there, ran after Elijah, and said to him, "First, let me go and kiss my mother, father and mother goodbye, and then I will go with you." Elijah replied, "Go on back, but think about what I have done to you." So Elisha returned to his oxen and slaughtered them. He used the wood from the plow and built a fire to cook their flesh. He passed around the meat to the townspeople, and they all ate. Then he went with Elijah as his assistant. So there are certain characteristics of God's call to Elisha, and that I think are very important. And there are four of them that I found. Now, Elisha's family was obviously wealthy. He was because they had 12 teams of oxen. He was capable. He was a hardworking leader. To his credit, he did not think so highly of himself that he couldn't work alongside his servants. But I see in his story four characteristics of God's call to sent ones. First of all, God's call comes over time and in a variety of ways. Secondly, God's call is unmistakable. Third, God's call requires obedience and sacrifice. And fourth, God's call comes with spiritual empowerment. Let's look at this first one. God's call comes over time and in a variety of ways. When God begins to call somebody, someone in a particular work or ministry, it's a supernatural conversation. And it's not a suggestion. Elisha's immediate and positive response to Elijah indicates that God had already been speaking to him. If not, when Elijah threw his cloak over him while he was plowing in the field, he probably would turn to him and say, "What are you doing? I don't need a coat. I'm sweating here like a pig. Why would I need a coat?" But instead, he understood exactly what was happening, and he said, instead of saying that, he said to Elijah, "First, let me go and kiss my father and mother goodbye, and then I will go with you." This is often the case when it comes to hearing God's call. He leads with a series of events. His word and conversations that stir our hearts can prepare us for challenges that, if obeyed, will change the trajectory of our lives and the world. So let me tell you about how God called me as a child. I'm so glad to see all these kids come up today, this morning, and I was called when I was a child, and it started when I was in fourth grade. I was at a mission school in Vietnam. My parents were missionaries in Cambodia. There were no English-speaking schools except the mission school in that area. And So one of our teachers invited us to an evening bonfire, and this was on a weekend, and so there were 8 or 10 of us in my grade, and we'd been told ahead of time to pick out a favorite verse and explain what it meant to us, and then we all got a stick and we would throw it on the fire, and this would, I guess, be a interesting experience for us. So we got there, and it was getting dark. It was dark, and we had the fire burning, and we all got our sticks, and I had forgotten to pick a verse. I'd totally forgotten about it. Everybody else, they were going around the circle, coming towards me, reading their verse, throwing. It was really impressive what they were doing. And I didn't have a verse. And so I had a little New Testament. I opened it, but the fire wasn't bright enough. I was trying to find it, and the teacher passed me a flashlight, and I finally flipped the page over, and this is the verse that I found. I looked at it. Of all those verses on that New Testament page, it was Luke 5:31. Jesus said, "Healthy people don't need a doctor, sick people do." Everyone looked at me in surprise, and I blurted out, "I picked that because I want to be a doctor and help sick people." Well, the teacher was quite proud of me. Everybody was genuinely surprised, so it turned out well. But I thought to myself that night and for a long time, of all the verses on the two open pages in my New Testament, why did my eyes go to that verse? Nothing is random in life. God is directing and calling us in many different ways. A year or two later, a missionary doctor came to our mission school, and he spoke to all the students in the school. He gave his testimony, and he talked about taking care of sick people in Vietnam, and especially poor people, and telling them about Jesus. And I was just fascinated. And at the end, he said, "I hope some of you will become doctors and do what I'm doing." And he said, "But it won't be easy. You'll have to go to school for at least 8 years in the university." And with that, my heart sank. That just sounded horrible. And so I forgot about that. But a few years later, when I was 14, we had been home on vacation in Cambodia, and now my parents were taking me to the capital city to fly over to Vietnam and back to the school. I was 14 years old, and we came on the scene of a terrible accident. A truck and a bus had smashed together on a curve. There were trees hiding. What was coming is just a narrow paved road, one lane paved road. And the bus had overturned. There were people with broken bones and bleeding noses. But the driver of the truck had really been seriously injured. Of course, in those days, there were no seat belts, and he'd been thrown against the steering wheel with the force of that. And they had dragged him out of the truck, and they put him up against a tree, and his chest was just crushed. We drove up there, and my father stopped, and he said, "David, get the thermos." Now, my dad had no medical training, but he thought, well, maybe we could somehow help. And so we went over to see him, and there was a little crowd of people standing around watching this man die. And so my father knelt down next to him. I poured the water into the top lid of the thermos, and he gave it to help this man try and drink this, and the man couldn't swallow. He was just gasping for air, and he spit it out. And so my father said to him in Cambodian, he said, "I'm a Christian missionary, and I came here, God sent me here to tell people like you about his son who came to earth. It's about as far as he got." And this man just shook his head, and he said, don't tell me about that. And he just, I mean, it wasn't as nicely as he said that, because he could hardly talk, and he just said, "Help me." And we couldn't. What could we do? And we watched that man die. Got back in the truck, and we headed back continued on our trip, and the rest of that day, all I could think about was, where did this man's soul go? He had one chance, and he didn't take it. And I was just so broken that man was not in the kingdom of heaven. He'd gone to the worst place in the universe. And I just thought to myself, if only we could have helped him. And I began again to think about, maybe I could become a doctor and help people who were sick and dying and tell them about Christ before it was too late. And maybe let them live long enough to hear the story of Jesus. And so that was really the most important call. And then when I was 16, a missionary doctor came to our town in Cambodia during one of my vacations, and I was able to volunteer a few hours a day in the hospital pharmacy. That was, again, an important experience that I saw. Now, if you want to read the rest of the story on my book, I have a book called On Call, and there's two of them in the back, and one of you can have these. I'd rather the kids got these first, but I'd be happy to give all three away. The way that God called Moses now was really unique. I think you'll appreciate that. His call to become a sent one is recorded in the third chapter of Exodus. The story starts with Moses standing as near as he dares to a bush that's on fire but is not burning up. And he's 80 years old, which is older than me. And he's been taking care of sheep in the Sinai Desert for 40 years. Now, you would think that somebody who had those qualifications would be of not much use to God. But in this case, you'd be wrong. Those of you who are retired and are thinking that your service to God might be over, you might want to pay special attention to this story. Then when 80-year-old Moses went over to investigate the bush that was on fire, God spoke to him from the fire, and he said, "Moses, take off your sandals. You're on holy ground." And now I want to give you an abbreviated version of this conversation. Then God says, "I am the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. I have seen the suffering of my people in Egypt and have heard their cry. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to save them from being slaves of the Egyptians and bring them out of that land to a good and beautiful land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Come, Moses, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you will bring them out and bring my people, the Israelites, to this land." But Moses replied, "Me? You want me to do this and stand before Pharaoh? I'm a nobody." God said, "But I will be with you, and you will bring my people here to serve right at this mountain." And it was the Mount Sinai. "Well," Moses said, "what shall I say to your people?" God said, "Tell them I am, Yahweh, has sent you. Tell them I have seen what the Egyptians have done to them in Egypt." Moses said, "They'll never believe me." God said, "What's in your hand?" "This? This is a staff. It's my wooden staff for herding the sheep." And God turned it into a snake. Whoa! Moses dropped it, and God said, "Okay, now reach down and grab it by the tail." Now, this is where some of us might have a problem if God called us in this way. But Moses, God, good for him, he did it. He bent down and he grabbed it by the tail, and it turned back into his staff. And God said, "All right, when Pharaoh sees you do that, he will listen to you." Moses said, "But I can't talk without stuttering. God said, "Who made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak." Moses said, "Please, Lord, send someone else." With that, God got really angry. He said, "Your brother Aaron is already on the way here, and he will speak to Pharaoh for you. I will be with your mouth, and I will be with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. Now go and stop arguing." And Moses said, okay, I'll go." God calls people over time and in a variety of ways. So we've seen several ways that God has called. I think it's unique for every person. But there are some things that are in common. And the second one is God's call is unmistakable. Certainly was the case for Moses. I've heard sermons praising the faith of Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and they did have great faith, and how after Jesus called them to follow him and become fishers of people, fishers of men, they immediately left their fishing boats and followed Jesus. They did. But Luke and John give more details about the preceding days. Part of that reason is because Matthew gave that account, and Matthew wasn't there yet. He wasn't one of the disciples yet. The Apostle John wrote in John the book of John 1:37, that he and his brother Andrew were standing near John the Baptist when John the Baptist pointed to Jesus and said, "Look, there is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." John and Andrew immediately followed Jesus. They left John the Baptist and they spent the rest of the day with Jesus. Then Andrew found his brother Simon Peter and told him, "We've found the Messiah." And he brought Simon Peter to Jesus, who looked at him and said, "Your name is Simon, son of John, but you will be called Cephas," which means Peter. 2 days later, Jesus and his disciples were guests at the wedding of Cana. Now, the disciples at this point are just John, Andrew, and Peter. So at Cana, when Jesus turned water into wine, they probably enjoyed some of it, along with the other guests. A day or two later, Luke describes how Jesus preached to the great crowd on the shore. When the front of the crowd started getting too close to Jesus, he stepped into Simon Peter's boat and asked him to push out from shore a short distance. Then he preached from the boat. So Peter heard the entire sermon. And so did his brother Andrew, and so did James and John, who were nearby mending their nets. After Jesus had finished speaking, he said to Peter, "Now go out where it's deeper and let down your net to catch some fish." From Luke's account, it appears that Jesus got into the boat with Peter and Andrew. After initially resisting and explaining that they had fished all night and they hadn't caught anything, Peter and Andrew did what Jesus asked and threw their nets into the water. Suddenly, their nets were so full of fish that they started breaking and the boat started to sink, and they shouted for James and John to come over and help them. So Luke says in Luke 5, verses 8 to 10, when Peter realized what had happened, he fell to his knees before Jesus, probably in the boat, and said, "Oh Lord, please leave me. I'm too much a sinner to be around you." For he was awestruck by the number of fish they had caught, as were the others with him. His partners, James, John, and the sons of Zebedee, were also amazed. Jesus replied to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people." And as soon as they landed, they left everything and followed Jesus. By the time that Jesus called Peter, Andrew, James, and John to leave their boats and become fishers of men, three of them had heard John the Baptist identify Jesus as the Messiah. Jesus had told Simon that his name would be Peter, meaning rock. They had attended a wedding with Jesus where he turned water into fine wine. They had heard him preach from the front of Peter's boat, and they saw him impossibly fill their nets with more fish than their nets could hold. Jesus' call to them had lasted over days, involving multiple events, and now it was abundantly clear what he was calling them to do. Give up fishing for a living and follow me. His call to them was unmistakable. Well, you might think, God might be calling me, but how do I know? How can I be sure? In his January 4th devotional of My Utmost for His Highest, Oswald Chambers wrote, "Never run ahead of God's guidance. If there is the slightest doubt, then he is not guiding. Whenever there is doubt, wait. When it is a question of the providential will of God, wait for God to move. When God gives a vision and darkness follows, wait." Waiting is not giving up. Waiting is praying, trusting God, letting God take the lead, not us. If God is calling you to become one of his sent ones, in time, he will make his call to you unmistakable. God's call is unmistakable. The third principle from the story of Elisha's call is that God's call requires obedience and sacrifice. Elisha's sacrifice was what he would have to give up, what was that he would have to give up farming, which he seems to have enjoyed. He would no longer be the man in charge, but would be Elijah's servant and helper. Obeying God's call would require Elisha to leave his mother and father. And that was only half of what God had in store for him. 17 years ago, a Gabonese pastor named Serge Batuboko accepted our invitation to serve as the administrative director of our hospital, Bongolo Hospital in Gabon. He had been an officer in the army, was intelligent, athletic, and a natural leader. He had an incredible story. 4 years after joining the army, he was chosen to receive training to become a parachute instructor. Serge excelled in his training, and 6 months later, he and nine others went on their last practice jump. It would be an easy jump from 10,000 feet onto a large sandy area south of the capital. When it was time to jump, the men hooked their parachute pull cords to the overhead cable. The pull cords attached to the overhead cable were supposed to automatically open their parachutes after they jumped from the plane, then detach. A sudden wind came up as they began jumping, and Serge was the last one out. But when he jumped, the strap that opened his parachute didn't let go. Still connected to the airplane, Serge was dragged wildly through the air at 200 miles per hour, just feet from the tail of the plane, and his parachute was a tangled mess. In that moment, he knew he was going to die. Seconds later, the officer inside the plane cut the strap holding him, and he plummeted to the ground. Because his main chute was tangled, Serge had the presence of mind to pull his secondary parachute, but as soon as it opened, it got tangled in his primary parachute. As he sped towards the ground, he shouted a desperate prayer, "God, if you save me, I will serve you." And he hit. Seconds later, he hit the water feet first and felt excruciating pain. That is the last thing he remembered. Hours later, a helicopter found him and rescued him, took him back to the capital city and put him in, and he awoke in the hospital, surprised to be alive. His commander came and congratulated him and told him his buddies were fine. A week later, however, he learned the truth. The wind that had started blowing just as they jumped from the plane blew all of his buddies out to sea, and they all drowned. Serge was the only survivor. It was a terrible blow. Can you imagine? All of his friends gone in that instant. Christians from a local church visit him the next day. When they shared the gospel, he wept and told them what happened and what he had promised God. A day later, Serge repented and put his faith and trust in Jesus. The visitors gave him a New Testament that he devoured and visited him daily. After a month, Serge was discharged with crutches. But when he told his commanding officer he was leaving the army to serve God, the officer put him in jail. After 2 weeks in jail, his unit commander came back and told Serge that if he didn't change his mind, he would remain in jail indefinitely. Serge said, "Do what you want, but I'm going to keep my promise to God." Frustrated, his commander sent a French psychiatrist to talk to him. After hearing Serge's story, the psychiatrist advised his commander to give him 2 years off because he had lost all his friends and probably felt guilty for being one of the only survivor. Several weeks later, Serge enrolled in a 3-year seminary. During the next 2 years, Serge's faith and Bible knowledge grew rapidly, and he led many of his former friends to faith in Jesus. At the end of 2 years, his commanding officer came and ordered him to return to his unit. Serge politely declined, stating that he had another year of Bible school, and God had called him not to be a soldier, but to be a pastor. His commander warned them that if he didn't return, he would spend the rest of his 10 years in jail, because he had not volunteered for 10 years. That Serge replied that if he broke his promise, God would not bless him. That got the commander's attention. After thinking it over, he said to Serge, "I fear God. If I make the devil angry and I ask God for help, he will help me. But if I make God angry, who will help me?" And so he said, "Get out of here and be a good pastor." Signed a paper for him, freeing Serge from his military obligations. Serge was ordained as a pastor and pastored a church near his family home. 5 years later, when the church needed a capable and godly administrative director, when we needed a capable and godly administrative director for our hospital, we asked Serge to come as the hospital's director. By then, the national church leaders had elected him to serve as the denomination's treasurer, but they reluctantly agreed. Serge and his family moved to Bangalore, And over the past 17 years, he has been an outstanding administrative director at Bungalow Hospital and one of my best friends. Had he stayed in the Army, I am certain that today he would be one of Gabon's top generals and a wealthy man. God's call requires obedience and sacrifice. God's call, the fourth one point is God's call comes with spiritual empowerment. We don't have time to go into Jonah's story. You know the story, I'm sure. But when he was finally ready to obey God and God's call to be a sent one, Jonah walked through the streets of the largest and most wicked city in the world with a simple message. 40 days from now, Nineveh will be destroyed. That was quite a sermon that he preached. Maybe he probably added other words. But the people of this wicked city believed God's message, and from the greatest to the least declared a fast, put on burlap, and showed their sorrow. Now that was spiritual empowerment. It took a while for God to get him there, but God is able to do anything. How many of you have heard of Amy Carmichael? Few hands? Yeah. Well, I want to tell you in part her story. Amy Carmichael was born into a devout Christian family in Ireland 156 years ago. When she was 21, she heard the great missionary Hudson Taylor appeal for Christians to join him in preaching the gospel in China. Amy grieved over the terrible fate of the millions of people, hundreds of millions of people throughout Asia who still had not heard of Jesus. And 2 years later, she sailed to India as a single missionary. She was shocked by the misery and the poverty that she found, and she longed to be one with the people and love them with the love of Jesus. But how? She was British. The country had been a British colony for 300 years, and the people hated the British. What could she do? She was unmarried. She was a foreign woman. She learned the Tamil language of South India, but faced endless barriers to ministry. In desperation, she spent hours praying and crying out to God to open a door for her. One day, the Lord said to her, "I will make a way." A short time later, she met two starving widows from the despised class called Untouchables. She gave them food and befriended them. Amy purchased a large tent that they could all live in. Soon after, a 5-year-old girl escaped from a nearby Hindu temple where she was being sexually abused. She fled to Amy's camp and pleaded for protection. Her name was Prina, which means pretty eyes, and she had never experienced a mother's love. She had been raised in the Hindu temple to be a prostitute. Amy tried to hide her, but a threatening crowd gathered and claimed that she had kidnapped the girl. Amy stood by Prina, and the little 5-year-old bravely faced the crowd and said, "I will not go with you." Surprised by Amy's courage, the crowd let her keep the girl. After that, whenever Amy heard that a mother was planning to give her baby girl to the Hindu temple, she went and pleaded for the child. Slowly, word got around that the strange white woman living among them genuinely loved Indian children, especially girls. With the help of her widowed friends, Amy welcomed more and more girl babies to her camp. As time passed, she and her volunteers saved more and more children, and more widows joined them. When she heard that male babies born to temple prostitutes were also being sexually abused, she rescued them too. She and her recruits soon found themselves feeding, washing, mothering, loving 20 to 30 babies and small children at a time. Can you imagine that? That is what a missionary, that was the work God gave to Amy Carmichael. She wasn't preaching to crowds. She was changing babies' diapers almost 18 to 20 hours a day. It was exhausting work and went on 24/7, but Amy's faith and determination grew with every child she saved. Amy was a gifted writer and started writing down the stories of the children and the widows. Her books became bestsellers in Great Britain and in the United States, and churches began sending her money. As the children grew into adolescence, Amy enlarged her property, built dormitories, built a church, schools, and housing for the widows who helped her. Over time, she even built a Christian hospital that served the surrounding community. In 1951, after more than 50 years of saving and serving the least of these, Amy Michael died at the age of 84 and was buried near her house. Most of her children survived, grew up, married, had families, joined a growing Christian community in pagan India. Many became leaders, engineers, nurses, successful businessmen, successful businesswomen, and even government officials. Amy Carmichael is an example how God's call to even the weakest comes with spiritual empowerment. Never think that if God calls you, he can't give you the power to carry out the mission he has made you for. These four characteristics are not an exhaustive list of the characteristics of God's call to sent ones, but I believe they are among the most important. And I'll repeat them here for you at the end. In conclusion, it takes a church. It takes a church and its sent ones to reach the world. What about you? Are you perhaps saying to yourself, well, I couldn't do that. I mean, I have a family. I have a wife. I have children. They'll never accept this. I have elderly parents that need my help. I have responsibilities in my church. I have unsaved brothers and sisters. Does God just expect me to walk away from them and 100 other obligations and ask others to support me? Does God expect me to go to some godforsaken place and serve him in some humbling way? If God calls you to be a sent one, the answer is yes. Remember, God's call comes over time and in a variety of ways. God's call is unmistakable. God's call requires obedience and sacrifice. God's call to become a sent one comes with spiritual empowerment. Let me end with these words of Jesus in Matthew 10, 37 to 39. If you love your father or mother more than you love me, you are not worthy of being mine. Or if you love your son or daughter more than me, you are not worthy of being mine. If you refuse to take up your cross and follow me, you are not worthy of being mine. If you cling to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for me, you will find it. If after the service or in the next few days or weeks, you wonder if God might be calling you to become one of his sent ones, and you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask, to talk to me, to call me. You can call the church. My wife, Becky, is the secretary. She'll give you my phone number. I'd be happy to talk with you, answer any questions you have. And I know that the same is true for Pastor Josh or the elders. The most important thing of all, if God is calling you to a ministry, whether it's here among homeless people or whether it's somewhere else in this country or if it's somewhere around the world, follow him, obey him, give him your life. You will change history with what you do. Let's pray.